This week on Making Contact.
Power and terror have become interchangeable, and we journalists have let this happen.
Longtime Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk knows the difference between real terror and rhetoric. He's interviewed Osama bin Laden 3 times and has been on the front lines with numerous armies, from the Syrians to the Israelis.
There is at the moment no sign of hope in the Middle East. I don't think there is enough land left for a Palestinian state.
On this edition, Robert Fisk speaks about the power of words in shaping public opinion and public policy, and the tragic consequences of a press corps that doesn't question the official line. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
I want to talk to you, and I hope we'll be able to talk on the subject that worries me most about the Middle East, and that at the moment is the subject of words and our use of words. I was very struck during the, I noticed we call it a Turkish flotilla. A flotilla, of course, is a naval convoy. The Turkish attempt to break the siege of Gaza, because the semantics of reporting it were very interesting, the way in which the words changed. And I was sitting in Beirut. We have a correspondent in Jerusalem, my paper, a friend of mine, who was covering it on the ground. And I took a note of how the phrases moved. They went like this: Islamic terror, Turkish terror, Hamas terror, Islamic Jihad terror, Hezbollah terror, activist terror, war on terror, Palestinian terror, Muslim terror, Iranian terror, Syrian terror, anti-Semitic terror. But I'm doing an injustice to the journalists who reported this and to the Israelis and to your own administration. The lexicon is this: terror, 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 terror. You're getting it, aren't you? Terror, 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 terror. I have it written down here 60 times, but you know the rest. We are in love with the word. We are seduced by it, fixated by it, attacked by it, assaulted by it, raped by it, and committed to it. It is love and sadism and death in one double vowel word. The opening of every television symphony, the primetime theme song, the headline of every page, a punctuation mark in our journalism, a semicolon, a comma, our most powerful full stop. Terror, 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 terror. Each repetition justifies its predecessor. It is self-perpetuating. Each terror giving birth to a new baby terror in the arms of father terror, a terror attack followed by a terror alert, followed by the prison of terror in which we all, of course, live, and yet further terror. Terror, 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 terror. Most of all, it's about the terror of power and the power of terror. Power and terror have become interchangeable, and we journalists have let this happen. Our language has become not just a debased ally, but a full verbal partner in the language of governments and armies and generals and weapons makers. Power and the media are not just about cozy relationships between journalists and political leaders, between editors and presidents. They are not just about the parasitic osmotic relationship between supposedly honorable reporters and the nexus of power that runs between White House, State Department, Pentagon, Downing Street, Ministry of Defense in London, the Foreign Office, and of course America and Israel. In the Western context, power and the media is about words and the use of words. It is about semantics, it's about the employment of phrases and clauses and their origins, and it's of course about the misuse of history and about our ignorance of history. More and more today, we journalists have become prisoners of the language of power. And for 2 decades now, the US and British and Israeli and Palestinian leaderships, they've been using the same kind of words. Peace process. Do you remember when peace process began? I think it was 1978 at a press conference I attended in Beirut with Cyrus Vance, who would, I think, have been your Secretary of State at the time. And you see, even the phrase peace process is a lie, because a process is something that proceeds, and the peace process has never proceeded anywhere. But we use the words peace process. It's become part of the language, the grammar of television reports, Fox News, CNN, New York Times, and on you go. Poor old Oslo, I often say, to be named after a peace process. And you can see what happens in this process. You see when it doesn't work, we've got a new cliche. You'll all know it. It is put back on track. Over and over again, the peace process was put back on track until it was a miniature train, a toy train. Of course, I love them. And it was being put on the railway line again. And then in the end, people got bored, so it became a road map. And our own beloved Tony Blair became involved in it. Then he voted the roadmap. We couldn't put the roadmap back on track, so we talked about issues, which is your word for problems. And then we abandoned it again. And 3 months ago, CNN, I was listening to it, referred to the peace process being put back on track. You see, there is no peace process. It is a total failure. What Oslo introduced was a totally unjust idea whereby all the most important issues, settlements, right of return, Jerusalem, had to be postponed to the very end of the process, when, of course, there wasn't enough time to deal with them. And anyone, as the late Edward Said said, who suggested during the process that we do discuss these important issues was told, no, you'll make the peace process go off the track if you introduce it now. So the language took us along on this false expedition to, quote, peace, unquote. Look at today in Afghanistan. We're regurgitating the same language. Over and over again, I've read in your newspapers more than ours, we have to win the hearts and minds of the Afghans. Bloody hell, this was a phrase that came from Vietnam. When we were going to win, you were going to win. Fortunately, Harold Wilson kept us away. Mr. Blair would not have done so. You were going to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese, and you lost them, and you lost the bloody war. And now we're using the very same words, partly, I suspect, because the young American officers in Vietnam are now generals in Afghanistan. They know what hearts and minds means. It doesn't mean anything, actually, but it's the phrase, the use of the phrase. Look how we use the word spike. It's come in. It started, I remember, another press conference I had the enjoyment of attending in the Green Zone in Baghdad in 2004. It was a man called Brigadier General Kimmett who talked about, we have a spike in violence, right? A spike. I hadn't heard this before, but all the journalists used it. It's only got four letters. It's very easy for a sub-editor to put it in a headline. And what does a spike do? Well, it goes up one side and then it goes down, you see. What he meant, of course, was an increase in violence, a word that does not carry the condition or the guarantee of a decrease afterwards, but we use spike. Okay, it's only a spike in violence. Or an uptick. That was a lovely one, an uptick in violence. And then we have the surge, which saved us in Iraq, which is why we've only got 50,000 non-combat troops left there, who have already been in combat five times since they were non-combat soldiers. The surge, you see, has this unstoppable quality, like a tsunami, a natural tide, unstoppable. You're going to win. Well, what a surge means, and we're now going to have this in Afghanistan, it means reinforcements. And you call for reinforcements when you're losing, not when you're winning. You remember the Battle of Kandahar? We were told in the early spring the surge was coming, we're going to have a Battle of Kandahar. And it never happened. We had the Battle of Marja, only Marja turns out it didn't really exist. And then in late spring, we were going to have the Battle of Kandahar. In the British press last week, I realized that the Battle of Kandahar is about to begin on September the 20-something. I don't think there's going to be a Battle of Kandahar. I don't believe in it. In fact, I don't believe in any of these wars. I think there's a kind of fantasy, which we use words to keep it at bay. I'm absolutely amazed at the way in which we as journalists have failed you, by the way we parrot the language of power back to you. We're always wanting to talk about competing narratives in the Middle East. It won't be a secret if I tell you that a long time ago, a British university asked me if I wanted to have some job as a professor of journalism and peace. And I said, what is this all about? He said, well, it's about competing narratives. It's a competition in which no one is occupied and no one does the occupying. It's just two people on a level playing field having an argument. And I realized very quickly what would happen. We get a bunch of poor old Israelis here and a bunch of poor old Palestinians here, and they'd rage at each other, and my job would be to say, oh, hold on, I think we have some common ground. Look at the other words. You know, we have a fence or a security barrier, the East German phrase for the Berlin Wall, instead of saying the wall, which I was there a few weeks ago. It's higher than the Berlin Wall, longer than the Berlin Wall, but it's a barrier. And instead of occupied territories, it's disputed territories, and so on and so forth. I mean, we can talk on this later. I don't think there's going to be a Palestinian state. I think there will be a one-state solution, and I fear it will be one state only, and it's going to be called Israel. And the Palestinians in Area C, we can talk about Area C, another one, Area C, just part of the Oslo Agreement. Area C is 62% of the West Bank, and it's gone because it's under total Israeli occupation. Settlements are continuing there. And when I went to one Palestinian village, they were not permitted by Israeli law to dig more than 3 inches into the ground, which is why they had huge concrete blocks to put the power lines in, because they couldn't dig a hole in the ground for the power lines. It's gone. In fact, I think that, you know, real figures and real words, I think Mahmoud Abbas is negotiating, if he is negotiating, for about 10.9% of what was Mandate Palestine. At the time of the Gaza siege, indeed at the time of the Turkish convoy, siege breaker, flotilla, call it what you like, what was very interesting was that, you know, there was a very good precedent for what we might have done over Gaza in a different place at a different time. It involved a people who were surrounded and starving. They were surrounded by a fence and a very brutal army. And we, Americans and British, our servicemen risked their lives and sometimes died to save those people, whom only 3 years earlier we had been fighting. We saw them as terrorists 3 years earlier, but we dropped supplies to them. We flew into their enclave, their ghetto, to feed them and protect them from the brutal army around them. And it was called the Berlin Airlift. Yet not once have I ever seen a report on television, on radio, not even on Al Jazeera, and I dared them to try it, mentioning that there was a parallel. If we could do the Berlin airlift for the people of Berlin, why couldn't we do a Gaza airlift for the people of Gaza? We all know the reasons. We all know the reasons why not. But our failure to point out that there was a precedent was part of the way in which we have succumbed to the language, the spikes, the surges, the peace process, the dispute rather than the occupation, and so on and so forth. And I have increasingly felt in recent years, and I've been in the Middle East for more than 3 decades, though that doesn't necessarily mean I know a lot. I know less each day, of course. But I believe now that, in fact, American policy can't be fixed. My belief is that militarily, not in any other way, but militarily, we must leave the Muslim world. It is not our land. They are not our people. We do not own that land. By all means, by all means, send our teachers, send our hydraulic engineers, send our social workers, anything if they're invited, but no more soldiers and M1, A1 tanks and swords and horses and Apache helicopters and Bradley fighting armored vehicles. And I think that for the same reasons, I also believe, and I had a long conversation again the other day with Amira Haas, who's a friend of mine, a very fine Israeli journalist whom most of you will know and read, and if you don't, you should, for Haaretz, a woman who's infinitely braver in her reporting of the brutal circumstances of the Israelis in her columns in Haaretz than any American journalist is in reporting from the Middle East. And we were talking again about what the job of a foreign correspondent is, and I was recalling that when I was at my first newspaper in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, there they taught us 50-50 journalism. You're covering a football match, Blyth Spartans against Gateshead United. So half your report has to be for Blyth Spartans, and then you do what, you know, write about what Gateshead United did. Similarly, a local authority inquiry into building a new freeway. You know, you report the local authority's needs to have this wonderful new highway for the public good. Then you report the protesters and why they can't, you know, drive this highway through rivers, lakes, and forests. 50-50 journalism. And I'm afraid that what's happened is we've taken this false idea of neutrality into the Middle East, like journalism school, ME, Middle East. And we're trying to report the Middle East as if it's a football match, when in fact it's a bloody tragedy. And I often make the point to my colleagues in the Middle East, you know, if you're reporting the slave trade, if we could, in the 18th century, we wouldn't have given half our story to the slave ship captain. We would have reported the slaves and recorded the number of slaves thrown overboard in the voyage from Africa to America. If we were present at the liberation of a Nazi extermination camp, we wouldn't give half our report to the Nazi reasons for hating the people they had murdered. When I was in Sabra Shatila in 1982, climbing physically over decaying corpses, I didn't give half my story over to the reasons why the Israelis watched and did nothing. I gave my story over to the survivors and wrote about the dead. When I was in Jerusalem, August of 2001, and a bomb went off, suicide bomber, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, in the Sabaro Pizzeria, killed 16 Israelis, more than half of them children. I did not give half my story to the Islamic Jihad spokesman, because I think it is a duty of a foreign correspondent to be neutral and unbiased on the side of those who suffer. And whoever they may be, but I have to finish by saying my little rant now, that I don't think you're going to get any different reporting. I think we're still going to go on hearing about the barrier, the disputed land, the peace process, the roadmap, keep the fence around the Palestinians, key players will sort it out. There's another lovely phrase we have, key players. And we'll be reminded all the time what this is about. Terror, 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 terror.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Now we'll hear more excerpts from Robert Fisk speaking on September 22, 2010 in Berkeley, California.
Empires historically must project power in order to survive. And the only way in which empires can project power is by threatening states outside the empire or by going in and invading them. Journalists, they are part of the projection of power. It's very exciting to actually advance with an army. I've advanced with all kinds of armies, many of them extremely unpleasant and gruesome. I've advanced with the Iranian army, then I've advanced with the Iraqi army, then I've advanced with the Syrian army, and I've retreated with a whole bloody lot. It's my problem in journalism, or issue in America, that I'm always in sort of Stalingrads with the people I choose to be with. I actually was with the Israelis several times in Lebanon, and they retreated too, so the Fisk curse affects all armies, you see. But I think that when you see these things, especially if you're embedded, you become part of the empire, you become part of this projection of power. It's exciting, it's a historic moment. We called the Oslo Agreement that, but there you go. And suddenly you start reporting, well, our furthest, our leading tanks are just approaching Baghdad, we're on the Tigris River, there's been some collateral damage, we've seen some terrible things, etc. Collateral damage, another word, right, which has seeped in. And then we use it without quotation marks, for God's sakes. We mean civilians we killed, as opposed to innocent civilians who are ruthlessly murdered by our enemies. These are collateral, so it didn't hurt as much when we blew them to bits, you see. And I think what happens is that because we have the same nationalities, the armies, you feel with them, you see they're young, they're handsome, they're heroic, all the things you've seen on telly. Hollywood comes into it, television, movies, and so we become part of the war, and we're dressed in military costumes, some of us. When I say that to journalists, they hate it because they want to call them uniforms, you see. They're not, they're costumes. They're taking part in the theater, like all the soldiers are. And it's this inability to take even three steps back and say, hang on, what is this tragedy I'm involved in? Because it's always a tragedy. If you saw what I saw, if you had anybody here who believed it was right to go to war and saw what I see, you would never think that again. You know, dead bodies of civilians in bits, dogs coming in to feed off them, carry off a leg over the desert to chew on. It's, you know, lunchtime for the dogs of the desert, etc. And that's how we respond, you see. We fail because we can't take the historical step, not historic, but historical step of saying, what the hell is going on here? What are we doing in Iraq? Somebody in Washington says we can change the world. We can go to Baghdad. Our armies can travel across Samarra, where civilization first began. And then you get the music and the letters in gold typing, and you're back on CNN. You don't need to censor the press. It'll censor itself. The journalists will do it. In many cases, again, I'm not trying to be cruel to my colleagues, not that I could be, because, as I say, many of them are trying to do what I'm trying to do. This is not Bob standing up like a light in the darkness. There's lots of lights around, and we're all struggling for the same thing, but the vast sort of the nexus of television journalism, front men, TV, here in Baghdad, etc., etc., etc. I had a very sobering experience during the 2006 Hezbollah-Israel war, because day after day, not every day, but day after day, I was traveling down by road to southern Lebanon from Beirut, where at least I could sleep in my own bed at night, even if it was a bit noisy overhead. And, of course, we were under sporadic Israeli air attack because they were obviously attacking all the terrorist cars on the road, including our terrorist car, if they could. I was reporting for The Independent in London, and my words were being used exactly as I wrote them. And I am very fortunate. I have a very good, brave, strong editor who's a friend of mine, and I've got a publishing company that backs me, and it's great. So I'm, you know, you can be as brave or courageous as you want as a journalist, but if your editor doesn't back you, you might as well become, you can run a fruit concession or a bus or anything you want. But what was particularly harrowing in a way for me was that in the afternoons when we were coming back, you see, the time between Beirut and the east coast of America is 7 hours. So on the way back at about 4 p.m. Beirut time, my American colleague, good friend of mine, fluent Arabist, been a friend since 1976 when I first met him when I went to Lebanon, would be in the back of the car calling his news desk in the United States. And the conversation, truly, it went like this. What was the headline on the story yesterday, this morning, right? I mean, yesterday's story, right? Yeah, but that's not what I said in the second paragraph. But I didn't write that. Well, would you put a Jerusalem paragraph in as a second They wanted balance, you see. Yeah, but surely the story yesterday was about the civilians who were killed in southern Lebanon. Bingo. And it went on every day like this. And of course, the desk would be arguing, well, you know, you had one side of the story, there was another side. I know you saw this, but the Israelis denied it. I had a wonderful scene years and years ago, 1985, when an AP reporter and photographer went from Beirut to Sidon. Sidon was then under Israeli occupation. The Israeli army had already withdrawn from Beirut. And they witnessed a crowd of protesting Palestinian women outside or on the edge of the Ain al-Helway refugee camp. And an Israeli soldier stepped forward and aimed at a rather large Palestinian woman and shot her in the stomach. And she died on the road. And there's a picture, you can see the guy with spectacles on. He's clearly identifiable. And then there's a picture of the woman lying on the road. And the reporter and the photographer, Paolo was the photographer, came back to Beirut and sent their story. And New York's, AP's bureau in New York, which is the head office, came back on the telex. We didn't have mobile phones in those days. It was all telexing. How many people here remember the telex machine? You're all old like me. Anyway, on the bell, up came the automatic telex back. You can't run this until we've got the Israeli side of the story. And the bureau chief, Nick Tatros, he said, but we were there. We've got the pictures. That's the story. But you see, it was so clear-cut that there must be another side. In the end, the Israelis denied the story in paragraph 2, and it fell off the lead. Of course it did. It wasn't. It was a suspect story. It was a bit controversial. The question I ask, and I'm not an activist, I'm a journalist, but I ask this question at press conferences in the Middle East, is why Arab families, by nature they are generally Arab, sometimes they're Christian, sometimes they're Muslim, whose families have been torn apart literally by American weapons used by the Israelis, do not or are not encouraged by people in this audience, for example. I'm not telling you to, I'm just asking you the question. To sue the American weapons makers whose missiles and rockets tear their families apart, literally. One of the things I do, because doing my job, you become a weapons expert. There's nothing I can't tell you about the air-to-ground AGM-114C missile, except that it was made in Duluth, Georgia, and is now made in Florida. And I found the computer plates of these in lots of places in Lebanon. An ambulance was attacked with a missile in 1996, just behind me. 3 children, 2 women dead. And a UN Swedish intelligence officer and myself got all the bits of the plates of the missile from the bodies in some cases and got them all to the United States, complete with fins, engine cone, the lot, in bits, of course, it had exploded, and took it to the Boeing manufacturers. And we had the developer of the missile at the table. They thought they were going to use me to advertise this wonderful missile. One of them said it can be fired from 3 miles away and go through a baseball hoop, which means the ambulance had no chance, you see. And they became extremely nervous. They exploded louder than the original missile did almost because I put the bits of the missile down the table. At first they denied it was a Hellfire missile. And then I turned to the PR man of Boeing. I said, that's a lie. You know it's a 114C. He said, yeah, it is. And then I put the pictures of the dead and wounded children and women on the table. And they were profoundly shocked. And the first thing they wanted to know is this about a legal action? What was particularly interested about this missile, in case you think the story is innocent, or easy I meant, is that my assumption was it had been sold to the Israelis. After I wrote the story, it was on the front cover of our magazine, returned to sender. Not a single American newspaper followed it up. A missile manufacturer in France rang me up and said it was sold to the U.S. Marine Corps, not to the Israelis. And I rushed back to Washington. It's great for frequent flyer points. You know, and I went to see the Marine Corps officers just outside Washington. They agreed. They were worried about this. Because it said 01, which is the NATO coding for American missiles, and then it said M, which is Marines. And it turned out that this missile had been sold to the U.S. Marine Corps by Boeing Lockheed. It had been taken to Saudi Arabia to be used against Iraqi forces in Kuwait in 1991. It had not been used. 350 of the 700 batch of the 114C were not used. And then the Marines were ordered to put the remaining missiles unused ashore at the Haifa munitions pier as part of an arms agreement with Israel, which was not advertised, to say thank you to Israel for not joining in the Gulf War at that time against Saddam Hussein. So this missile started off in Duluth, Georgia, went to the U.S. Marine Corps, was taken to Saudi Arabia, up to Kuwait, back to Saudi Arabia, onto Haifa, and was fired at the ambulance behind me 10 years after it was made. But what was particularly interesting is when I rang Lockheed up, they said, what are you ringing me for? It's like asking a person who makes a knife, is he responsible for a guy who gets killed by the same knife years later? The answer is no, but if you sold a machine gun to a man you know was going to misuse it, you would be in court. So my point is, I don't think, if you're interested in doing this kind of thing, I don't think that sanctions, which can catch Israelis who in many ways would support the things you say, it's going to catch them too, particularly on the academic grounds. I think that a much more serious issue is to ask you why Arabs do not, or why you don't encourage Arabs who have suffered physical pain to their families, go to the source of the weapons that kill them and wound them. I'm not advocating it. I'm asking you why you don't. And I told you the little story about the anxiety of your largest missile manufacturers when I put the question directly to them with photographs of blood.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from a speech by Robert Fisk in September 2010 in Berkeley, California. To listen to a full-length, unedited version of his talk, go to our website, radioproject.org. Special thanks to Carl Jogbandhan Singh, Marie Choi, and Andrew Bevington for helping produce this show. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Pauline Bartoloni, producer and online editor, Khan Pham, associate director, Carl Jogbandhan Singh, volunteer coordinator, Daphne Young, station relations, Rachel Kozlovsky is our production intern, and Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, Alton Bird, Andrew Bevington, and Marie Choi volunteers. And I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.